Mr. Keith Natterio, 7. We were talking about your time in the Samichon Valley, or in the hills behind it, don't be, you know. But
yes.
What about latrines? What were latrine arrangements?
Well, latrines were a bit basic, really. This is why when I see females with soldiers in front line positions, I think, I don't know how it's going to work. I mean, all our latrine were basically was one of these shell cases in the ground for a urinal. You know, that was, I'm talking about sandwich composition. Right, the toilet facilities were basically a ration box, a wooden ration box, we'll say, like about 2 foot square box, or 2 foot by 3 foot box, and somebody had, and we'd take the middle section of the bottom of the box out, and that'd be positioned over a pit, and then there'd perhaps be a cardboard flap on it, and at one period that'd be replaced to sit, you know. But we've had poles over trenches, but the Samichon, I think that's how it were there in the Samichon. Maybe refined a little bit. We maybe got a bit of, if I remember right, a bit of camouflage scrimming, and put a bit of scrimming around to keep you out the cold wind. But it was basically all in the ground, you know, with something over it so you could sit on. You know, and this is why I say I can't see how females can expect to serve with males in active service conditions. I mean, another instance of that, my other signaller, we're on about dirty conditions again. He got a problem. He got a problem with his penis. You know, he said he it hurt. So he said, I'll go sick. So he went to see the MO. Nothing sexual diseases. The MO says, well, it's your dirty conditions you're living in. He said, what I suggest? He said, I'll give you some stuff. He said, put it in one of your small accessory tins. He said, put it in there and dip your old boy in it, he said. And so water was, in the winter, water was scarce because, you see, you couldn't, nothing, the jerry cans would freeze. So anyway, this was, all we could wash in was these small tins of water. You used to boil one up over somewhere near your fire and then have a wash. And so this, my other signaller, so he'd had to get this drop of water warmed up and dip his old boy in it. You know, it was filthy conditions. But I often think, well, how the hell are you going to do it in a situation with females? It'd never work. But anyway, that's just to me, I like the dirty conditions.
Tell us a bit more about the washing, and, you know.
Well, the washing, that was it. I mean, we were quite dirty. When we went from, I keep going back, but I remember little things. When we went from the other side of 355 to join the Princess Pat's and done the digging, not all my knuckles got knocked as we were digging these trenches, and they all festered, these knuckles, and I could have went sick if I'd have wanted with these knuckles, and if I'd have went sick, they'd have sent another signal to C Company. This highlights the love I'd got for C Company. If I'd have went sick, I'd have went back to battalion headquarters to join the signal platoon. Right, they'd have sent another signal to replace me. That'd have been it. The MO had most likely sent me to RAP at the back, and they'd have done me hands, and they'd have been made better in a few days, and that's it. But I'd have been then in signal platoon in battalion headquarters. Well, I didn't want to do that. I'd soldiered with these blokes in C Company, and I really wanted to be in C Company. So anyway, I soldiered on with these, and I've got a photo out there, which I'll show you before you go, and you can see the plaster over my fingers. And in the end, I got this, one of the stretcher bearers used to come and put me two or three new plasters on a day, and in the end, they cleared up. But that was dirty conditions, and so we couldn't wash. I mean, we used to boil a drop of water and have a wash, and I got a little mole on my top lip, so I thought, well, I ain't going to cut that with a cold, you know, I wouldn't shave, and so I'll grow a moustache, and it was a terrible one. Major Alden said, Ginger, we'll have that moustache off one of these days, because he had got a proper moustache, you know, it was a shocker. Anyway, that, you know, we scraped around with a razor when we could, and we washed when we could. And there were one bloke there, and we often joked he didn't take his balaclava off hardly all winter. He used to just see his face, and that was it. But nobody could be much different, you see, really. We were all in the same boat. I mean, okay, Major Old Neil Everbatman, and he'd perhaps be got a little canvas bowl thing. He could ever wash him, because the Batman had got nothing else to do, only look after his needs, you know. But
tell me about Major Holden. What was he like? Give us an idea of what he was like as a bloke as well as an officer.
As a bloke, he was fantastic. apart from his military skills, which must have been great because he was awarded the Military Cross in the Second World War, and as you know, you don't get them for nothing. As a gentleman, he was super. Everybody in the company loved him. He really did. I'll give you a little few examples, because we were only 1 foot from him, you know, through this hole in the wall. O'Neill, his batman, was a bit of a character. Right, now Major Alden used to have to go to O groups and meetings, then battalion headquarters and things like that, you see. And okay, say Mal had come up. Not perhaps all the while, but say for this instance, I can remember this instance. Mal had come up and when Major Alden weren't there. So Mal had been distributed, you see. Now anyway, Major Alden comes back from the O group and he says, words to the effect, "No Mal, O'Neill." "No, sir, sorry, sir." "Oh dear, so I were expecting some mail. Did you get some?" "Like O'Neill perhaps said, yes, sir." "Oh dear." Anyway, then he perhaps picks his, I don't know, his coat up or something off the bed. "O'Neill, you wretched man," he'd say. And he'd give Mal, he'd be there, you know, and he'd take it all in good part. He really would. He'd take it in good part. And there were once, while we were in the sandwich on position, we were digging reserve position south of the MGM called the Kansas Line, just in case we had to do a quick bug out. So everybody had to have a reserve position so they can, you know, get out in a hurry. You know, you just want to aimlessly wander around the hill. You've got your positions there to go into. This were January sort of time, I should think. And so each company used to send a few back to get these positions dug in. So anyway, Major Alden come back there and we went on a three-tonner, or maybe two or three three-tonners from different companies. And Major Alden was in charge, and it was a winter day and it was a lousy day. And anyway, it hadn't rained, I don't think. We'd been digging and it was all rock. We were on Gloucester Hill, I think, was their reserve position. That's what the rumour were. And I would think it could be, because it was just south of the MGM. And we were trying to dig and it was rock, and we'd got the sappers blowing, you know, the rock for us. Anyway, we had a hard day's digging there, and it was getting towards tea time to come back, you know, for last night. So Major, he come on to pour rain. Okay, absolutely throw it down. So Major Alden said, "Everybody back to the jeep head," because we were on the hill, so we had to come back down to the truck head. And it was throwing it down, and blimmin' icy wind blowing. Major Alden's jeep were pulled up with his driver in, you see. And Major Holden wouldn't get in his jeep while every last man was on them trucks. He wouldn't. And he was getting soaked, and he was going back to holding the ground like we were. Remarkable man. He were loved dearly. He were. And then another little instance. Remembering these, and I'm telling you. Now, this was on the position we were when KOSB got attacked. Right. One of the platoons come on the field telephone. I wouldn't mention the person's name, because I'll say, they said, "So-and-so, so-and-so, he shot two men." "Ah, oh, Major Alden, so-and-so, so-and-so, he shot two men." Of course, we're going to bring them down to... Sergeant Major picks the phone. "Bring him bloody down here. I'll deal with him," or words to that effect. Anyway, so the old boy comes down from the platoon who'd done the shooting. It appears he shot one bloke with a Sten, went through him into the other bloke. Only accidental in the dinner line while they were dishing up food. Sergeant Major stands on the top of the hill. This poor old boy comes up. You know, somebody's helping him up. Not the one who shot, the one who done the shooting. Sergeant Major stands there, hands on his hips. "You bloody animal. You're going to be bloody locked away for this so-and-so name." You know, as he comes up the hill, he's shouting and swearing. Major Holden come out. "Leave this to me, Sergeant Major. So-and-so, Sergeant, come in here." He took him and his dog out. Give him a drop of whiskey or whatever it were he gave him. Had a talk to him. And as far as I know, that man went back to the platoon and no other action were taken. Now, that's good. He didn't do it on purpose. That's good. So that Sergeant Major, he could be a bit of swine. Everybody loved him. Most people in the company loved him. But
is Sergeant Major Bell.
Well, yeah. Yeah, it were. Sergeant Major Bell. He made my life and mine and Danny's life a misery. He really did.
Why?
I don't know. He didn't like it because Major Alden... Well, I think he didn't like it because Major Alden called me Ginger and he called the other signaller Danny. I don't know why. And the officers naturally called me Ginger and the other signaller Danny. I don't know why, but the Sergeant Major did not like it. When we moved to this position in the Samichon, I told you about the sleeping bags, how big they were. Right, we couldn't carry them. So they took them around in the Jeep, in the trailer on the Jeep, and dropped them at the Jeep head. And see, we had to wander up these hills at this new position in the Samichon. So as we wandered by, the company blokes, sorry, Major, pick your sleeping bag up, you see. So they all picked sleeping bags up, just, you know, on the shoulders, because they got small packs on, the weapons. Made way out the hill. Now, I got 31 set on with an aerial. The other signal got 31 set on. So some of the blokes going to give us hand, you see, carry these, put them in there, carry their own bloody sleeping bags, you see. So in other words, we had to go up to the flipping hill, come down to get the sleeping bags. He was a devil. He did. He honestly, he made our lives a misery. Yet when we were in a position, and if showers began to fall, he'd come in there, scurry in there, dug out, and he'd sit there talking nice as like. He would, but he really did. He really made me and the other signaller, he made our life a misery if he could. I mean, he didn't get us down because you had to do what, you know, you had to grin and bear it. You couldn't do much about it. And I weren't going to bellyache to Major Holden about it. Nobody would. No, this is it. You don't bellyache in the army in them days. You just grin and bear it, and that's it. But he did lead us a flipping life. Going forward a bit, just to indicate while we're on about him, this, we're going back to the spring. We'd moved position again. And I'd been told I was on patrol that night. So when you're on patrol, you don't, you know, okay, they say to go in the bottom of the hill and test your weapons. So you just go and make certain your weapon's all right. And you're the rest of the afternoon off, you see. So this was a lovely spring day. We'd had all the winter. So anyway, I got on top of the dugout. I put my ground sheet down, took my shirt off and lay on my belly and went to sleep. Which was I was entitled to do, you see, because I was on patrol. Anyway, I woke up and I couldn't move my back hardly. And we got in little steel mirrors and somebody held the mirror. And I got blisters on my back about as big as your hand. You know, I'd been asleep. We hadn't had my shirt off since we'd gone through the blooming Mediterranean, perhaps, or, you know, the last summer. And I thought, flipping heck, I can no way I can carry 31 set, you know, with back like this. So anyway, Sergeant Major got to hear about this, so he comes and he says, what's the matter? And I said, I don't think I can manage to carry that blooming set. He said, if you don't carry that set, he said, you're on a court-martial, self-inflicted wound. Oh, flipping mile on. So anyway, in the end, I went to see the stretcher bearers again, and he padded me back with cotton wool. And it weren't too bad. I mean, I can't remember it causing undue pain. But that's just an instance. The other signal would have took it. You know, he would have took the patrol. It wouldn't have made any difference. I mean, we both as conversant with the 31 and patrolling. But no, he just made an issue of that. But that's just going forward again. But anyway, that's our lot. You know, he really was a bit of a swine.
Now, what was your sort of typical day like when you were in the Samichon? Take me through a typical day. What time would your day start?
Well, every day in Korea, actually, every day started half an hour before first light on stand two. The bloke who were on stag, as it coming up to first light, he'd have to wake all the company up, or the company headquarters in my case, and then you'd have to stand to, and that meant I think that meant establishing the net with air position, you know, with company headquarters, and you stand to for quarter hour before first light till quarter hour after first light. And it was same in the evening. That was the evening stand to, quarter hour before last light to quarter hour after last light. And that was regular routine. I don't think we'd done it when we were reserve battalion. But we done it when we were in the line. You know, reserve battalion, you were only back a little way because you weren't really out of shell fire. An instance of that was when we were in reserve battalion, battalion headquarters got hit by a shell. The RAMC corporal, the medical corporal, who come from Northampton, got killed in battalion headquarters when we were in reserve position. So it shows...
I'll come back. Yeah. So after stand two, what would happen then?
Well, after stand two, you'd have your breakfast. I mean, if the old deal ever be down his cookies, you'd go down and get the... No, your egg and bacon, whatever you've done, yeah? And basically, then it'd be digging and wiring. Because, okay, until you've got a nice communication trench communicating all dugouts, you've got to come out one dugout, scurry along to another dugout. So if you could get communications trenches dug, you know, about 4 foot deep, or maybe a little deeper, circling from dugout to dugout around the reverse side of the hill, you know, so it was maintenance of the position, basically, tidying up our wiring. Let's put another row of wiring down the bottom, you know, and that sort of thing.
But But would you be on that, or would you be on the signal duty?
No, you were on wiring as well. No, there were two signals, you see. And if we were in a static position, the radio wouldn't be on all day. They'd be using field telephones. So the radio would only be on perhaps for stand to or for any patrol activities like that. Yeah, field telephones would be the source of communication.
So you'd be on improving defensive positions?
Or improving defensive positions, yes, we would. Or some of us going back, on Kansas line, doing reserve positions there, yeah. And then, but then times, you see, we had got, the Canadians had a shower unit, a kind of mobile shower unit.
Tell me about that.
Well, I can't remember too much about it. It used to take us back in a third of time from the Samichon position, and we could then start having showers perhaps once every few weeks or whatever. It weren't a regular daily thing, or I don't think it was a weekly thing even. But you could go and have a shower, which were nice, you know. And then I think about that era as well. I think the clothes used to go away, like your underclothes and your shirts go away. And I think they used to go somewhere to sole. I don't think you had the same ones back, but you had replacements come. Korean used to get them washed, I think, somewhere behind the lines, you know. So you're getting clean kit then once a week, clean shirts and that, and pants and vests, you know. But yeah.
So what else would happen during a typical day? You'd be on, you know, your defensive.
With defensive positions, I suppose we got a bit of free time.
Now what would you do in that?
You'd really. I weren't much of a reader. Some of the lads used to read, playing cards, but not for money. Money really weren't of any use to us because they weren't much you could spend it on.
What did you do? Did you play cards?
I used to play cards a bit, but I didn't. I weren't a great card player. We used to have sing songs actually. If things, we'd have little singing popular songs, harmony groups singing some of the old army songs from, things like that. Yeah, that's what we did.
About letters and parcels from home?
Well, parcels from home, Mum used to send me a biscuit tin filled up with the food goodies. Coconut macaroons used to keep. So we used to get one of them. We often used to get stuff from home. Mum's biscuit tins didn't arrive all that regular because, but one instance, when we were at the sandwich position, this was before Christmas, the stuff got there well in advance of Christmas because it had come by sea mail and nobody knew how long it would take. And Mum had sent a cake, and among other things, in this biscuit tin. And then we had to move position. I don't know quite why, but then we went back again to Sandwich Hunt. But when we had to move positions, bear in mind you've got to carry what you got. We eat all the Christmas goodies before we moved out, you see. So when we come back, we were there for Christmas in the Sandwich Hunt again. I don't know why we moved out, and I can't remember why. But I know we eat all the cake and that. And it weren't just me.
What would you get in the tin?
Well, now, Mum had put me coconut macaroons. I know one thing. I had a mouth organ that was given to me in the war by an American when I was a kid, and she put this mouth organ in. But this blimmin' parcel had been pilfered way down the line. Somebody had helped herself to it. Yeah, so I never did see that mouth organ. I don't think quite a few odds and ends she'd put in there. It's all somebody who end up the sharp end who do the pilfering, before it gets to you.
What about letters? Would your Mum write to you?
Oh, yeah, Mum wrote regular. Yeah, Mum did write regular.
What did she write about? What sort of letters were they,
Well, telling me about local news, I suppose. And she did send me the local paper. She used to send me the local paper. It used to be Rosin Echo and Argus. She'd collect a few of them and bundled up in a newspaper reference, and it comes sea mail. And another instance relating to the Echo and Argus. She sent the Echo and Argus. I used to give it through to Major Holden to have a read. He used to put his Country Life and all his gentlemen's books, the Tatler and all them sort of things. It all go around the company for a read, you know. And I used to give him the Echo and Argus. He got one in there one day, and the colonel called in, evidently went in there to see him. And this was Sandwich on position. And Colonel come from Hinnick, which is only about 5 miles down the road. He didn't live there. That was his country, his family country house, you see. I didn't know nothing about, coming like that. Because, officers that didn't mix, the colonel didn't mix much. Anyway, he then comes up. This was, I think, after Tom Henson's sandwich on patrol. Or it may have been one before that. But around about that era, the patrols have been getting shot up in the valley. So the colonel then says, right, this not to me, he said this to Major Alden, evidently. He said, right, he said, I'm going to have a look at where these patrols are having all this action. He said, and so he says, what I'll do, I'll have an all Rushden patrol. This is fact. So he has me, my friend who I went to school with, Keith Vaughan, who was in C Company. These were all C Company boys. David Underwood, who I also knew from school days, slightly older than me, because he didn't remember while he was 21. So Keith Vaughan, Dave Underwood and me, Major Alden and the Colonel. And we went on a recce patrol. So anyway, so it was snow. So we put snowsuits on. And right, and he says, don't bring your wireless. Well, that was, for me, that was a, let me, wireless, crikey, no communications. What happens if he wasn't covering fire or blooming wounded coming out, you know? So anyway, he said, don't bring your wireless, just your Sten gun. So fair enough, so we should, oh no, O'Neill come as well. O'Neill, Major Alden Batman. So we go out on this recce patrol, and as it happens, well, any patrol that goes out into the Sandwich Channel is similar to any patrol anywhere. But I can always remember how the Sandwich Channel patrols used to go. You'd wind your way out through the little village, Tarrick Tay, it were called, I think. You'd pass the last listening post, that would be down the front spur of Ariel or wherever, and then you'd weed your way out. Now, that patrol, if I remember right, Major Alden would be leading it. And Major Alden, now the weapons would make you laugh. Major Alden got a shotgun and he's 38. The colonel had got American carbine. O'Neill had got a 303. Dave and Keith had both got 303s, and I got a Sten gun. So anyway, I don't know what we'd have done if we'd have run into any heavy opposition. But anyway, we went through, and the situation is, it was a frosty night, snow on the ground, so yeah, everything clear as a bell. Major Alden, before I started, by the way, Major Alden used to say to me, take your chewing gum out, because I used to love chewing gum, and the scent of the chewing gum makes certain it carries. So I'd all either make certain I were chewing old gum, or I weren't got any in my mouth at all. You weave your way out, Major Alden were leading, and you see, now the thing, this is on an ordinary patrol with no radio, so I knew what were going on. But bear in mind, well, I'll tell you how the ordinary patrol went out first. You'd go out there, and Major Alden, he'd go far ahead. And then he'd freeze. You'd just listen, because every saying carries. Then he'd go on again, and perhaps a flare would go up at one of the companies, you know, further along, and you'd down and not move. You know, you'd freeze until the flare's gone out. Then you'd go on again. Every few yards, you'd freeze, and you'd scan the, you know. And that, I was just taking the part of an ordinary rifleman, so we all went down and froze. We went on to the Sandwich Arm. Over all these paddy fields, we didn't see a Chinaman, we didn't hear a Chinaman. We got to the paddy, you know, to the Sandwich Arm, and we come back a different route back, and got back for first light. But what I'm going to try and say now, and that was a patrol like as an ordinary rifleman. Now you do that same patrol as a signaller with a 31 set on your back, not so much the weight problem, but you see, you've got your earphones on, right? Take them off and you've got mush coming through. You know what static sounds like from here. So you can't take them off, really, because static coming through, the Chinaman would hear it. So you got your earphones on. You're dependent 100% on the people around you, because you can't hear a thing. So you're going along, there's perhaps patrol commander in front, you know, Tony Tell, for instance. You're perhaps coming right behind him, because he's got to be near him for handing the microphone. You can't hear a thing, so you're relying totally on these men. Now, when they freeze, you freeze. If they go down, you go down, because you can't hear a thing. Now the only way I overcome this problem, when we were searching Tombstone for the wounded of the patrol, which we may talk about.
No, you're running ahead there.
Am
yeah.
I?
Yeah.
All right. Well, I'll like this one here. I'll come back to that then. I'll come back to that, Peter. But what I was just trying to emphasise the fact that if you go by a service vehicle like a fire engine these days, you can hear the static coming out. You just imagine you can't hear that blarting out the headsets, you know. So you've got to wear them over your ears. So it is. You're just dependent on the blokes around you, you know, and this is it. And that's basically how a patrol would be, you see. But some patrols, they have to go like Tom's, who we're perhaps going to talk about, or you know about Tom's patrol went out to make contact with the enemy.
Now, that was on the 3rd of March, I think.
That was it, it was.
Now, was Olabar's patrol after that or before it?
I'm not sure. It could have been. He wanted to see where these patrols were getting in their action, but there were some before Tom's as well from other companies.
There
were
some in December and things like that. Yeah.
So I'm not sure when it was before Tom's or after. I think it was before Tom's. I really do.
Right. So what about? What do you remember of Henson's patrol?
Well, Henson's patrol, I don't remember anything because I were in Tokyo 5 days.
Right. So
this is why I'm knowing that. This is what made me know the colonel went before then. Because when I got back from the colonel's patrol, in the signal dugout, a phone call come through, would you send somebody who warrants R&R? And when I say warrants, it's on a scale of how long you've been in Korea. And each company could send one man to rest and recuperate in Tokyo. And it was my turn to go. And I can always remember, I got back from this patrol, Major Holden said, you might as well go, Ginger. He said, you're due for it. It's my turn, you see. So I went. And then Tom's patrol happened while I were away.
Now, what do you remember of your time in, of your R&R?
Oh, good Lord, R&R. That was an experience in itself, R&R. Now, you're coming from a frontline position in pretty rough conditions. Okay, it ain't horrific like the poor old boys in the First World War where you're going over the top every 5 minutes. But you're getting shelled periodically and you're seeing people die who you know. I mean, you know, you're seeing people who you soldier with, sadly they've been killed or wounded and whatever. But okay, you go down then to the GPED and you go down then to one of the rear echelons. You leave your combat kit there and they give you BDs. I don't think they're your own BDs, I'm not sure. But anyway, give me clean battle dress. Then you go down to the airport and you've got an airplane. It weren't my first time as flying because I'd already done it at Abingdon. But anyway, a lot of them had never flew before. And it was an American transport plane. And we sat all around the side of it on little, you know, I forget what it were, what sort of plane. Might have been a Globemaster if that were the sort. Anyway, they take us off and... you know, we see Fujiyama as we come into Tokyo and land. And we've got 5 days of rest and recuperation. And you come into a city, what to us boys, were like New York or Hollywood. You've got flashing lights, you've got beer houses, nightclubs. Oh, dear. So you've got really... You've got to cram... You tried to cram... as much living in 5 days as you could, you know.
Where were you staying?
Well, when we stayed at, I think it was a hotel, Commonwealth Division's hotel. But from then on, you're a free agent. If you don't want to stay there, you don't come back. But you had to be off the streets by 10 o'clock. Well, locals did. I don't know quite whether it was our service, but there was a curfew anyway. But I'm not sure whether it implied to us. But so we stopped at the hotel and then we went and done all sorts of things. On the last night, this is going back, this is shooting through lots of pleasant memories, but the last night we were there, we went to this club, and I think one of the ships were in somewhere. Anyway, there were a lot of naval blokes there. I'd never drank apart from port and Christmas and things like that, and these sailors, they gave us whatever it were they were drinking. Of course, I'd passed out. I can remember being sick in the toilet. I can't remember anything else. I don't know who got me kit out. I can remember the Americans when I was trying to get up the steps into the plane. I can remember the American captain or pilot or whoever he were saying it. He was at the bottom of the steps. We don't take drunks on this plane. You know, and anyway, they talked me on and I got on the plane. I can't remember the flight home. I can remember coming round and everybody off the plane. This was where we landed. I got off the plane. I didn't know what I was going to... I know I was at Seoul or round about there. So I itched to lift up to the battalion. I can't remember much about it. I can remember getting to the battalion. I can remember finding my way to C Company. And I can remember going up the hill to C Company. And I can remember Major Holden standing on the top of the hill. And he's got his hands on his hips. And he said, words to fetch... Wow, my goodness, Ginger, what have you been up to? You know, I can always remember that. But anyway, it were 5 days of riotous living, and everybody crammed as much in them 5 days as they could, because we knew we were going back the same holes in the grain. And that were lovely. That's just part of my... that's lovely. And now I'm back then, my R&R were done. Oh, another thing about that, R&R. While we're talking about R&R, Jock Hardy, the medical corporal, Corporal Hardy. There was a medical RAMC corporal in each company, you see. A Scotchman, come from Glasgow. He says, when you go on an R&R, because we always get things for people, you spend your own money on your pleasure. But the blokes at the company say, get us a camera, get us binoculars, you know. Cause they tell you what they want because they're seeing other blokes bring them back. And they know what they cost them. So anyhow, Jock Hardy says, go in the American club and bring me back some Canadian club whiskey.